nothing I could do. Barrett says he thought about his case and Reggie's. I know what it's like to be a young kid who gets into an accident, he says. But he thought the similarities only went so far. I don't know that you could compare the cases. Terrell wrestled with two thoughts. One, she didn't agree with Tony. And two, she respected him as much as any prosecutor she'd ever met. She'd come to the second realization some years earlier, when they'd had a difficult back and forth over a tough case. Baird hadn't brought the maximum charge, and Terrell was upset. In the end, Baird had to remind her that her aim should be justice, not the maximum penalty. It really moved Terrell, and since that time, she tried to embody his message. He's my favorite prosecutor, she thought to herself. But that didn't mean she always agreed with him. The ultimate decision on how to proceed fell to Daines, the county attorney, though in practice, this process was more democratic than tyrannical. As the conversation wore on, it seemed like he was siding with Baird. There just wasn't precedent here, and there were just so many resources in the office. He drew out a middle ground. Terrell, if you can find a prosecutor to take it, then we'll pursue it. In other words, he was leaving Terrell an opening. He knew what he was doing. He knew what would happen if he gave me an opportunity. He knew exactly what I was going to do. There were 7 lawyers who worked for the county, not including Daines. He was elected. The rest were county employees whose job status was not reliant on elections. Among the 7 others, Don Linton, the chief deputy county attorney, held relative primacy. He'd been around for many years, working regularly with Terrell. He had a nickname for her, the spark plug. The other attorneys knock. Everybody else knocks, Linton says of Terrell's habit of bursting into her colleagues' offices unannounced. She never knocks. Terrell saw Linton as someone who didn't flinch in taking on unusual or tough cases. He'd had a particular interest in going after rapists and child abusers. Terrell figured Linton was her best shot. Just a few minutes after the meeting with Baird and Daines, Linton, in a corner office opposite Daines, was face down in some papers. Terrell throws open the door and says, "Hey, I need to talk to you." "Okay," Linton said, both curious and bemused. Terrell held a rose-colored piece of paper, which she extended to Linton. Without looking closely, Linton could see bullet points, an explanation of some kind. "Don," she started, "I've got something you have to do." Linton gestured to one of the armchairs. "Slow down, Terrell," and she took a seat. "These 2 rocket scientists were killed," Terrell began, as she launched into the story of the accident. Up until then, Linton hadn't heard a word about Reggie Shaw, hadn't read about the case in the paper. He started to take it in, listening to the narrative and analyzing it from several sides. From a legal perspective, his primary stance, he wondered, what was the law here? He couldn't and didn't make a snap judgment. Instinctively, Linton also reacted to the story as a father. He and his wife had 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls, the youngest being Libby, 19 years old at the time, and Linton thought of her as a terrible driver. A great musician, very bright, but not a good driver. Linton believed that she sometimes tailgated and sometimes sped, and he knew that she texted a lot. He suspected she did so when she drove. He almost immediately started thinking about the case not just from the victim's perspectives, but, as he puts it, from the perpetrator's perspective. And also from the position of other possible perpetrators, including kids like Libby. I was thinking about my daughter and her life, and how it would change if something like this happened to her. Linton glanced at the memo Terrell had handed him, and could see now that it was a set of facts and assertions mirroring what Terrell was telling him. An outline of the case. As Terrell concluded, she said, "George isn't interested," referring to Daines. Terrell finished by saying, "I'll do all the work, but you have to do this for me." Of course, that wasn't realistic. The victim's advocate couldn't do all the work. Linton didn't commit. He told Terrell he'd do a little research, but she had piqued his interest, in a way he says likely wouldn't have happened absent her intervention. In fact, he recalls it was this conversation that set fate on its course. "When she came into my office," Linton says, "that was the spark that ignited the whole thing." It is a sentiment echoed by Singleton, who says his efforts and conviction fell on deaf ears with the prosecutors until Terrell started pushing. "If it hadn't been for her, no one would ever have heard of this," he says. "It would have been a few months out of my life and a stack of paperwork that would have gone into the shredder. When you meet her, she's a very nice woman. She doesn't seem like a hardcore person," he says. "But if you want someone to go to bat for you, she's the one." She was just getting started. And now, so was Linton. Linton, like the others in his office, didn't know much about the subject of texting and driving. He considered the concept a mysterious bog. He was 52 years old, a different generation, the last child of eight, who spent his first 12 years on an orchard farm where his family raised sheep and chickens. Still, even as he admitted that he might not be in the mainstream technologically, he was surprised at how little he could find on the subject of texting and driving and the law. He wasn't the only one who hadn't heard much about it. It just wasn't out there. There was one case out of New York that was vaguely related. He went to Terrell's office, and he told her he was coming up empty. The two nearly laughed about it, as if to say, "Well, that shouldn't stop us." But still, Linton needed more than he had in order to make a decision. He returned to his office. As he was searching online, he kept coming across one name, Dr. David Strayer. He was this local guy, a professor at the University of Utah, who seemed to be an authority on the risks of texting while driving and talking on the phone while driving. This fascinated Linton on two levels. A guy merely 80 miles away knew as much about this as anything else, and more substantively, Dr. Strayer's research had showed that using a phone behind the wheel was as risky as driving drunk. The thing that struck Linton as he reviewed Strayer's research was what was happening inside the brain. He thought, "I had no idea how much attention the mobile phone took from driving. We were wondering if this was like driving while drinking a Coke until Dr. Strayer came along," Linton reflects. "Then I realized it wasn't like drinking a Coke. It was like driving drunk. Really drunk. The precedent that tipped it for me was not legal. It wasn't a precedent of what was going on in other states. It was a scientific precedent," he says. Since 1990, when Dr. Strayer had begun digging into the issue of driving and attention distraction, he'd studied the subject from numerous angles, amassing a host of papers on various nuances. For instance, in 2001, he published a paper in Psychological Science showing how motorists got distracted just talking on a phone. In the Journal of Experimental Psychology in 2003, he showed that such cell phone-using drivers don't see as much of their surroundings as drivers not on the phone. Even if they're looking at the road, he'd found, their visual acuity was impaired by the cognitive demand of the phone. Also in 2003, he made a presentation at the International Symposium on Human Factors, showing that cell phone use impaired drivers to the same level as a 0.08 blood alcohol content, the level of legal intoxication in most states. At another conference a year later, he showed that cell phone-using drivers are less focused on the road than drivers talking to a passenger in the car. The reason is because the passenger acts as a second set of eyes, modulating his or her conversation based on roadway conditions. Not so the person on the other end of the cell phone, who can't see what is going on. In 2007, Dr. Strayer showed that motorists using cell phones do not get better with practice. Along the way, Dr. Strayer was doing other research related to aging and attention, studying some of the impairment associated with Parkinson's. But the majority was on driving and distraction, and most of it was not well-funded. Dr. Strayer was operating on a shoestring budget, eking out grants, and he thought he knew why. In whose interest was it to discover that there was a risk to this thing that everyone loved doing, and that was one of the most culturally celebrated activities, multitasking? Still, Dr. Strayer had amassed a trove of data, much of it peer-reviewed and published in respectable scientific journals. and some of the most important coming from a researcher in Linton's backyard. He'd made up his mind. Now he had to tell Danes. He hoped it would be a simple conversation, but there were layers to this case, political hurdles just below the surface. Linton knew that Danes, as an elected official, must be acutely sensitive to the community. After all, one wrong move, and Danes could face bad press, an angry electorate, and then a motivated opponent. Simple realities. That said, Linton knew that Danes had been fair and put justice first in past dealings. An added wrinkle had to do with the church. Reggie was LDS, like three-quarters of the just more than 100,000 residents of the county. That didn't mean that the prosecutors gave breaks to members of the church. They had plenty of prosecutions to show otherwise. Terrell herself, after all, had gone after a bishop years ago. At the same time, Reggie wasn't just a member of the church. He was a poster child for many of its best-regarded attributes. Clean-cut, church-going, family-focused, committed to going on a mission. He was an athlete and a decent student, things people in this county wanted their kids to be. He looked nice. He was nice. As Linton was on his way to go talk to Danes, these things percolated. This kid was on an LDS mission, and that is highly regarded in this valley. We knew we'd have to pull him off the mission, he recalls. The political ramifications were very high. Linton felt the science was so clear that it trumped any unstated risk from Reggie's church ties. But then, Linton also had a secret reason for looking a bit differently upon the influence of the church. Born on a farm in Utah, Linton came from a family without much education. Initially, they made ends meet in part by selling off plots of their 26 acres where they'd raised animals and had some orchards. Dirt poor. Eventually, they parted with all the land and moved to the outskirts of Salt Lake City, to a poor neighborhood. Linton started to run with a rough crowd. In high school, he had a friend die of a meth overdose, and his best friend was a drug dealer. Meth, marijuana, quaaludes, but mostly LSD. He once spiked Don's drink with LSD, leading to a horrible trip that left Don curled up in the corner of his bedroom, afraid he was going to fall through the floor. This was, after all, the late 60s. Linton didn't make a habit of it. His dad told him, if you ever start taking drugs or drinking, don't come home. He respected his father. His dad had those big biceps. But he didn't fear he'd get beaten or anything like that. The family had a heritage of not drinking and a religious faith. But when it came to the church, Linton was being told one thing while having a very different kind of experience. It happened the first time in the church, in an isolated area. The perpetrator was a well-regarded church member. Linton was 7. He remembers the man putting a hand down his pants and fondling him. From that point on, for 3 years, the man used his position and good reputation to groom Linton, isolate him, intensifying the abuse. He manipulated Linton's family into allowing him to spend private time with the boy, even overnights at the man's house. Linton didn't tell anyone. He felt he shouldn't. He couldn't make any sense of it, this terrible, shameful thing being done to him by an authority figure, someone no less so well-regarded in the church. Linton felt he must have done something wrong. I felt God had deserted me, and I couldn't figure out why because I'd been such a good kid. The experience made a profound impression on him that led him to think twice about the difference between spirituality and religion, between faith and the institutions that deliver its message. At least, that's how he came to terms with all of this later on, in a rational way. At the time, he couldn't make sense of his life, of the role in it of such a prominent authority that he couldn't trust. He got depressed. He heard voices. He went on antipsychotic medications. One thing that helped Linton find his way was music. In the 4th grade, the music instructor told Linton he ought to play the violin. He went home and his dad said, "No son of mine is going to play violin." So the family rented him a saxophone, and he took right to it. Linton became good, earning first chair in a jazz ensemble in junior high school, and then high school, and winning scholarship opportunities to play music in college. Sure, he listened to Led Zeppelin and Hendrix like everyone else, but he loved Coltrane, too. Music was an escape from it all. The poverty and rough circumstances around him, the proximity of sexual abuse. Maybe he'd be an art teacher someday, he thought. By 19, some of the pain subsided, at least it seemed. Then another trauma. His beloved older sister Kathleen got very ill, first with cancer, and then from the radiation treatment. He would read to her at her bedside as her condition worsened, and he prayed, sometimes blaming himself like he'd done when he was abused. "I thought maybe Kathy wasn't getting better because I'd done something wrong," he says. "No matter how much I prayed, no matter how much I fasted, she was not getting better." The mind-numbing, bizarre thoughts I'd experienced years earlier started to come back. She died when he was 21. At about that time, Linton went on his mission. This was what his family desperately wanted for him. And he supposed he wanted it too. It was hard to make sense of things. He was assigned to go to Belgium, but his first stop was Provo, the mission training center, the very place that Reggie had been. Like Baird, Linton was identifying with Reggie, but for different reasons. While Baird could identify with the clean-cut boy in Reggie, the one who had made a fatal mistake, Linton could empathize with someone who was in the middle of a mission that was about to end abruptly. In Linton's case, he'd gone to the mission training center and spent 3 weeks there learning French. He'd felt deeply unsettled, then depressed. And then, one evening, he got out of bed, put on his clothes, and left. No warning, no explanation. He got home and told his parents he wasn't feeling right about it. They were mortified. Linton was taken to talk to an athletic coach at BYU, who told the young man he was a quitter. A member of the church told him he'd regret the decision the rest of his life. Of Reggie, Linton says he understood. Pulling him off his mission was going to be incredibly hard. Linton himself had left one, and knew what it was to be a young man in peril. But Linton, while he believed in God, had lost his reverence for the church. It was cover for his abuser. It was not sacred. And so he was free to look differently at Reggie and the case. It was another sign of the interesting role Reggie was playing. Depending on a person's life experience, they saw Reggie and his actions in slightly different lights. Baird saw Reggie's case one way, Linton another. Such was the razor's edge of right and wrong that texting and driving played at the time. It seemed possible to view Reggie and his actions through different lenses. Over time, Reggie would become both a lightning rod and a prism through which people in the community, prosecutors, legislators, and others around the country would view themselves and their own behavior. When Linton told Daines of his decision, they had a decent back and forth. Daines expressed some skepticism, but he respected his colleague and appreciated the scientific background that Linton presented. Linton walked out of the meeting and asked his assistant Nancy to put together the paperwork for the charging document. Linton recalls thinking, "I had a lot of sympathy for Reggie. I knew this was going to be horrible for him." In the same breath, he thought that this prosecution wasn't just necessary, in a weird way, it was perfect. The perfect test case. The perfect way to set precedent. Not with someone who was malicious, not with a societal outlier. Reggie Shaw was the perfect person for me to prosecute, not because he was evil, but because he wasn't evil. I don't know how to say that. I don't know how to put that. But I knew it. Chapter 29. Reggie. Reggie was feeling high a month into his mission when it came time for his first missionary conference. This was a gathering of around 100 missionaries for a pep talk and celebration. It was held in Saskatoon, about 160 miles from Regina, a three-hour drive across the northern Great Plains. Reggie was particularly excited because of the speakers who were going to be in attendance at the retreat. They included Elder Clayton, one of the members of the Quorum of the 70. This was a high calling in the church, one of the elders, figuratively and literally, who would travel to teach congregations. Also, speaking the first morning were two district presidents and their wives. After the speeches, Reggie felt ebullient, so fired up. He returned to his room. He was resting, getting ready for dinner. There was a knock on the door. Reggie answered. The visitor said, "President Morgan needs to see you." "Have a seat, Elder Shaw." Reggie sat in an orange cloth recliner, nothing fancy, right out of the 1980s. President Morgan stood next to a desk. He was tall with brown hair turning gray and a wide smile, though he wasn't wearing it now. "Elder Shaw, I hate to tell you this, but you need to go home." Reggie's eyes filled with tears. He didn't have to hear more. He had been so happy before this moment. He'd come where he wanted to be, needed to be, had put that horrible thing behind him, not just the wreck, the thing with Cammy, everything. He stood up. He lifted the orange chair. He threw it across the room. He began bawling. President Morgan let him pour out his frustration and rage. He said gently, "The state filed charges against you. We got a call from John Bunderson." The summons and charging document had been submitted on Tuesday, August 21st, though word had not reached the church and Reggie until a few days later, on Friday. The summons ordered Reggie to appear in court on the following Tuesday on the charge of negligent homicide, a Class A misdemeanor. It was signed by Judge Thomas Wilmore, who had drawn the case. He'd been appointed to the bench in 1999 by then-Governor Michael Levitt, a Republican. President Morgan tried to calm Reggie, but the young man was inconsolable, turning inward. President Morgan gave him his instructions. "Return to Regina. Pack your things. Tomorrow, you go home." At the apartment, Reggie called his parents from the apartment landline. Nobody answered the phone at the Shaw's house. He tried his mom's cell phone, but she didn't answer. He called his dad's cell. "Who is this?" his dad answered. "It's your son, Reggie." "Oh, sorry, we're at the high school football game." Reggie felt a moment of anger. "How could you beat a football game?" He even asked. "It all happened so fast, Reggie. They decided to press charges. Negligent homicide." It was just like his dad, Reggie thought. To the point, matter of fact, life will go on and we'll be fine. More likely, Ed was just overwhelmed, paralyzed. It was his greatest terror, the idea of his son in jail. "They pulled the phone records," his dad told him. "They said that when the accident happened, you were texting." "There's no way that happened." "Reggie, we'll pick you up at the airport tomorrow." "There's no way that happened." "That's not what happened," Reggie said. He could hear the football game in the background. This wasn't happening. "We'll get you at the airport." They hung up, and it crossed Reggie's mind that while his parents would be at the airport, he might not be. He could take off his LDS badge, change into street clothes, and get a job in Canada. A few days later, back home from a mission for a second time, Reggie couldn't eat. It was virtually unheard of for a missionary to return home twice. His stomach was in knots. He got ulcer medication. His mom took him to see Galen, the longtime family friend and counselor. Galen saw in Reggie a person who seemed at his wit's end. She asked him to fill out two questionnaires, the Burns Anxiety Inventory and the Burns Depression Checklist. The tests had questions you answered on a scale of 0 to 3, with 0 meaning something wasn't a particular concern, and 3 meaning the client was bothered a lot. Anytime a client would notch a 2 or 3, moderate or a lot, Galen paid close attention. Among Reggie's scores, fear of losing control, moderate, a 2. Fear of cracking up or going crazy, moderate, a 2. Fears of criticism or disapproval, a lot, a 3. Pain, pressure, tightness in the chest, 3. In all, on the anxiety test, Reggie's answers added up to a 35. That was a red flag for sure. Any score over 31 signified severe anxiety. On the depression test, more of the same. Was he feeling sadness? Down in the dumps? 3. Low self-esteem? 2. Are you self-critical? Do you blame yourself? 3. Have you lost your appetite? 3. Reggie, you are in a severe stage, she told him after reviewing the numbers. She recommended that he get a prescription for an antidepressant. He drove home, drained but not feeling any better. Later, he and his mom got a prescription from a local doctor. But when he got home with the prescription, he went out back of the red brick house. He pulled the prescription out of his pocket. He tore it up. He put it in the dumpster. He thought, this is something I can handle. I can deal with this. And there was something else going through his mind. The pills would make me feel a false sense that everything was okay when nothing was okay. The pills would make me feel like everything was all right, and I could just live every day like they were all right. He knew his mother would find out from Galen he'd gotten medication. So he told her he'd filled out the prescription and was taking the drugs. Another little tiny lie, right? Would it be harmless? Reggie and his family met with Bunderson. What the lawyer heard overwhelmingly was that the family wanted to fight. Reggie too, but Bunderson's impression was that the family wanted it more. Regardless, he started putting together ideas for a defense. His impression on its face was this was a triable case, one he had a reasonable chance of winning. As Bunderson sought information, he was curious about Reggie himself. Exactly who was this kid? How might a jury react to him? Let's go back, Mr. Bunderson said. He wanted to talk about what happened before the accident. Before? Your mission. What happened there? Reggie fidgeted. I had an issue with a girl, Reggie said. Recalling back, Reggie reflects. He gave me a look. I need to know the details, the lawyer said. He asked Reggie whether he'd feel more comfortable if his parents left the room. Reggie said they could stay. He explained about how he'd lied to Bishop Lasley, telling the lay leader that he'd not had sex with his girlfriend. He was trying to figure out how I lied and why I lied, and if something would ever come up in court about how I lied before about big issues. The stuff with the mission, questions about his own character and his own mind, weighed heavily on Reggie, more than he let on. That was a character problem, and I realized that at that point, it could affect potentially more than my mission. It could affect anything I had to say in court. Bunderson realized it too. It could be a huge problem. Assuming, that is, the prosecution convinced the judge to allow such evidence. If the prosecution were to tell a jury here in Utah that he'd lied to his bishop about something he'd done before going on a mission, then they might think he's lying about everything. But as Bunderson thought through the possibilities, he figured there were some very good ways around that ever happening. Yes, this case was winnable on that front, and a lot of others. Chapter 30. Hunt for Justice. On the morning of September 18, 2007, Leila O'Dell put on a black floral skirt and a matching sweater. She drove her Prius to the Cache County Courthouse. In contrast to the more traditional surrounding architecture, such as the county attorney's office across the street, the three-story courthouse sports steel trim around a checkerboard of clear glass windows that stretch the building's height. Inside, light bathes the hallways. The sun, or flat light on a cloudy day, pours in from every window. If there are secrets here, it seems to say the light will quickly find them. Leila took the elevator to the third floor and entered courtroom 5. It was large and packed. This was not just a hearing for Reggie, but for many others being arraigned. She found Megan and Jackie and Terrell. They sat in the long brown courtroom pews, taking in the light through the south-facing windows and views of the three sets of jagged-topped mountains reigning over the three canyons beneath them, the Logan, Providence, and Blacksmith Fork Peaks. Linton sat at the front. He got his first look at Reggie in person. He was struck that there was something different about this kid from virtually every other defendant in the place. No tattoos or piercings. No shifty or menacing look. Something all-American about this guy. Megan O'Dell glared at Reggie and thought, "You killed my dad, and I hate you." For Leila, sniffling, holding it together, it really wasn't about Reggie. It was about Keith. Regardless, she also believed that this whole thing, the entire deadly affair, was about to reach some kind of closure. Reggie was going to plead guilty, of course, she thought. The evidence with the text records was, as they say, black and white. Judge Wilmore also saw Reggie for the first time. The judge had grown up in Logan, graduated from high school there, attended law school in Sacramento, California, then returned home and practiced law for 16 years before being appointed to the bench where he'd presided for nearly 7 years. In his chambers, his bookshelf kept histories of great men like Ben Franklin, Harry Truman, and, most cherished by the judge, Lincoln. Two books were more cherished than the others, and he kept them in his desk. One was a big blue manual for Alcoholics Anonymous, something he consulted often, because so many cases he presided over involved addict defendants. The other was a beat-up paperback edition of Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, in which he'd underlined passages in red and blue pen. It touched on so much of what he faced. Crime, rehabilitation, the role of the system for good and sometimes ill. He'd gotten the State versus Reggie Shaw by lottery, a random assignment of cases to one of the four judges in the district. A veteran, he approached this stage of the process, the arraignment, with efficiency. Meaning, he didn't get too invested in individual cases, or even wish to be particularly informed about them, because there was no point in doing so. He didn't know if someone would plead guilty, not guilty, or reach a plea. He and others in the system referred to this mass arraignment as a cattle call. "How does the defendant plead?" he asked when Reggie's case came up. He had short manicured hair, slightly graying, and he spoke quietly in a way that suggested he was restraining in intensity. Bunderson responded, "We enter a plea of not guilty and request a preliminary hearing." Leila was incredulous. "You're kidding me. You can't be serious." Her mind was racing. This was supposed to be so straightforward. The judge set a date. Leila and the others were struck by what she called Bunderson's belligerence, but he was doing his job. They might as well have been reacting to what they saw as a travesty of justice. It was the first outward sign he was going to fight zealously for his client in what he saw as a winnable case. Just after the hearing, the families, Leila and Megan and Jackie, along with Terrell and Linton, went down the hall in the courthouse to a conference room. They had a short meeting where Linton tried to set expectations. He told them that jury trials can be unpredictable, even though he thought they had all the facts and the law on their side. He gave them a 30% chance of prevailing. He was trying to set realistic, if not conservative, expectations. He was not surprised that Bunderson was pushing the issue. He suspected that a different defense attorney, maybe someone the Logan prosecutors knew better, might have taken a quick plea bargain. Not Bunderson. Linton had already begun preparing for a full-blown trial. On August 15th, about a month earlier, he'd written a memo to all the attorneys in the prosecutor's office. It was titled, "Texting While Driving." "Last night I found out that on August 7th, 2007, he wrote, "a Harris poll was released showing that 89% of American adults believe that sending text messages while driving should be outlawed." He went on to say that despite this awareness, amazingly, 64% of the adults in the survey said that they had sent a text while driving. Linton was thinking, people did it, but they knew it was wrong. If they looked inside themselves, they could see the disconnect. They'd sense that Reggie should have known the risks of texting and driving, that he must have known. He concluded in his memo, "This might be an important issue in any trial conducted in State versus Reggie Shaw, and how we choose the jury and approach the issue." These same issues were going through Bunderson's mind, too. His first thought was, who knew? Who knew this was grossly negligent conduct? He was thinking, who had told the public you weren't supposed to text and drive? Where were the studies? Who told Reggie? A second big issue for Bunderson had to do with the evidence that Reggie was texting at the time of the accident. Yes, the phone records clearly showed some texting activity, but they didn't prove that Reggie had been texting at the exact moment of the accident. He thought, they won't prove that he was texting at the exact moment. And he felt a jury would be much less inclined to convict Reggie if the best the prosecution could do was show that Reggie was texting 30 seconds before the wreck. If Reggie had been texting 30 seconds earlier, Bunderson thought, how could that have anything to do with the accident? Bunderson was putting together other defenses. He was looking at investigative misconduct, small and large. Could he find problems in the investigators' pasts, something that might call into question their credibility or capability? On September 11th, he wrote himself a memo indicating he'd spoken with Brianna Bishop. She'd told him about her two interviews, the first one at the law enforcement offices, but the second time at her work. He writes, the second time one of them came to her work and embarrassed her. In addition to these smaller things, there was one huge issue on the investigative front. It was a question of whether Rendlesbacher had mishandled his initial contact with Reggie. Bunderson wondered whether Rendlesbacher's testimony could be tossed out because he hadn't read Reggie his Miranda rights, the warning that informs a criminal suspect in custody that he or she has a right to remain silent and has a right to an attorney. There was no disputing that Rendlesbacher had not said this to Reggie, but to Bunderson, he should have. When the trooper took Reggie to the hospital, I thought that Reggie was in custody and interrogated, Bunderson says, even though at the time, Reggie had not been arrested or charged with the crime. If he could show Reggie should have been given such a warning, then he could have Rendlesbacher's testimony tossed. But that wasn't really Bunderson's aim. He had a larger goal. He wanted to keep Reggie from having to testify. Since the only statements Reggie had given were to Rendlesbacher on that day, they would be the only statements that Reggie would have to personally address to the jury. Without Rendlesbacher, there would be no Reggie. And that meant no tough examination of what he remembered from the accident. No asking him to explain the phone records. No asking him what he knew about the risks of texting and driving. And no asking him to reveal why he'd left his first mission. Reggie, nice and quiet though Bunderson thought he wasn't someone the lawyer wanted to see testify in his own defense. The sum of all these strategies that Bunderson was thinking through added up to one more tactic. Stalling. The longer they could draw this case out, the more it might find its way to the bottom of the pile of prosecutorial priorities. And the more the public concern about two dead rocket scientists could ebb. Bunderson made no bones about it in talking to Reggie and his family. It's rarely in a defendant's advantage to hurry things up, he said. The longer you give the steam to go out of a situation, especially this one, the death's got a lot of press, folks were reading the newspapers, the more they would tend to forget all about it. He told the Shaws, let's not be in a big hurry. Each passing day seemed to fuel the other side, anxious for closure. This was particularly true of Terrell, who kept digging and digging, seeing a great injustice that stretched beyond Valley View Highway on the morning of September 22nd, 2006. On November 19th, amid the back-and-forth motions and delayed trial dates, there was a testy interview that symbolized not just the antagonistic tenor of a case that would drag on for well more than a year, but also highlighted the ways in which society at large was struggling with how to think about our relationship to technology. What is okay? What can be proved? What steps are we willing to take to protect ourselves and our own from truth and consequences? Singleton and Rendlesbacher were interviewing Mary Jane Shaw. It was 9:31 in the morning. Mary Jane was joined by Bunderson and her son Phil Shaw. Both sides came in with guards up. The family thinking Rendlesbacher overzealous. Separately, there was civil liability, with Phil worrying they could take everything if the Fafaros and Odell successfully sued the Shaws. The investigators, meantime, saw the Shaws as meddling liars. Not only were the sides confronting each other, the person at the center of the whole thing was Mary Jane, Reggie's mom. his fierce protector. That was the context going into the interview, which Singleton would later describe as the most contentious I've ever had in 24 years in law enforcement. It started politely enough. It took place in a small conference room on the top floor of the county attorney's office. Singleton recalled that, before the official interview took place, Mary Jane had mentioned to Rendlesbacher, "I saw you at the temple the other day." Singleton took it as light code for, "We're pals, and I'm a good upright LDS person." Singleton was LDS too. Mrs. Shaw answered Rendlesbacher's questions about the weather, saying it was horrible. She talked about finding Reggie at the scene, how she hugged him, and asked if he was okay. Toward the end of Rendlesbacher's questioning, things began to get testy, as the trooper asked whether Mary Jane had told Reggie not to cooperate with the police. She said no, she hadn't done that. Then things really intensified when Singleton took over the questions. "Walk me through the events of September 22, 2006. Start from..." Phil cut her off. "Objection. Asked and answered. She has only to answer these questions one time, Singleton, and you've already tried to ask her by going over them. Ask, Singleton. You can either butt out, Mary Jane. It's okay. Phil, don't give your opinion here. Singleton, I'm not here to talk to you. Phil, don't ask questions that she's already answered or she will walk." As the interview continued, there emerged all the contours of the battle. The idea that Reggie's the victim of zealous prosecutors, a veritable witch hunt. The suggestion he'd been a liar, with his family as co-conspirators, egging him on with his deception and denial. But it's a bit later that, with equal intensity, the conversation turned more directly to texting and driving, and whether Reggie was doing it, and whether, regardless, it could be proved he was doing it at the time of the wreck and had caused the wreck. These exchanges are important, because they frame a debate that was never so succinctly argued in the courtroom, given the long and drawn-out legal process. This was, in a way, a proxy for some of the reasoning in a jury trial that kept getting delayed and delayed, and a proxy, too, for the larger policy issues that allowed society to keep at bay the simmering legal and policy conflicts and challenges. Singleton. The cell phone records indicate, through the investigation, that Reggie was text messaging at the time of the crash. Phil. Objection. Do not answer this question. Speculation. They don't know the exact time of the crash. They do not have phone records to show if he was text messaging at the exact time of the crash because they do not know the exact precise second of the crash. Do not answer this question. Singleton. I'm asking if cell phone records show the crash happened at that time. Phil. Objection. No foundation. Don't answer this question. A little later in the interview, the subject came up again, this time with the question being, again, what Reggie had told his mother about texting and driving. The questions now were coming from Rendlesbacher, who, curiously enough, had taken on a bit of the good cop routine, with Singleton asking the more pointed questions. In answer to Rendlesbacher, Mary Jane said Reggie had always maintained he was not texting. He's never, ever, in a year and how many months, said anything different. And a bit later she said, he said no, he was not at the time of the crash. At any time? Rendlesbacher asked. I didn't ask him at any time. I asked him when the crash happened. Were you on the phone? He said no. For Phil, there was no lingering doubt. Not exactly. But he was vaguely aware of the complicated psychology at work. Reggie maintained he hadn't been texting. Phil also didn't personally look at the texting records, and looking back, he felt that, for all of Reggie's assurances that he hadn't been texting, Reggie might have been taking cues, too, from the family. The intensity with which the family undertook the defense had a self-perpetuating and escalating force. Reggie denied texting, the family backed him up, and Reggie, never someone to let others down, dug in deeper. He was kind of quiet, and then everyone took over. Me, my mom, and dad, all in his defense. And he just went with it, he said. Chapter 31. Hunt for Justice. January 18th, 2008. Dear Ms. Odell, I felt sad to read your letter, and recalled the tragic incident that took the life of your husband and co-worker. I have only followed the case in the news, and I think the filing to the charges under these circumstances was somewhat new. Thus began a letter to Leila from Utah State Senator Lyle Hilliard, a Logan lawyer and one of the most powerful state senators in Utah. He was writing in response to a letter Leila had written to him a few weeks earlier, asking the senator to take on texting and driving. In his reply, Senator Hilliard wrote that the January session was coming up in only 3 days, and therefore he wouldn't be able to do anything about the issue this session. But he said he would refer it to his staff for study to see if it was worth undertaking a year from then. You raised a legitimate issue that I think the legislature needs to look at seriously. We all need to remember that when we drive a car, very serious consequences can occur if we are not paying our full attention to what we are doing. Just a few days later, State Representative Stephen Clark was driving up I-15, the big highway that runs through Utah. He was heading from Provo to Salt Lake City, the very drive, in fact, that Reggie had made with his parents after his first mission came to an abrupt end. Traffic was bad and Clark was rushing. He was chair of the Appropriations Committee in the Utah House of Representatives, where he'd first been elected in 2000. A contractor by trade, he focused on commercial infrastructure projects, like plumbing and heating. He was a Republican, like most of the legislators, but a moderate one, meaning he was dyed-in-the-wool on issues like abortion, and was a fiscal conservative, of course, but he was willing to consider less strict rules on things like immigration. He'd tried, without success, to get a law passed to allow immigrant workers to get permits to work in the state. As he drove up I-15 in his 2002 gold Lexus, he shook his head with frustration. He was going to be late for the legislative session. He pulled out his phone and texted his secretary. "I was late and traveling fast, and the traffic started backing up," he said. He finished his text. When he looked up, he discovered the car in front of him had come to a stop, and he was about to slam into it. "I slammed on my brakes and just barely missed ramming him." He was mortified by his own behavior. He felt an almost immediate sense of resolve. Despite his history of fighting government regulations, he decided he wanted to do something about texting and driving. "This has got to stop," he decided. "It's got to stop not only with me, but with those who are going to be behind me texting." Something else, he said, flashed through his head, or rather, someone else. He thought about this kid he'd heard about, Reggie Shaw. He'd read about Reggie when the accident happened, and he thought about that accident now and again as he'd watched his own behavior and that of others on the road. As he continued his drive to the state house, he says, "I thought to myself, I could be another Reggie. I could be in a situation like that, or I could be like those rocket scientists." But there were some realities to contend with. One was that it was too late to introduce legislation for the 2008 session. More worrisome over the long run was the reality of Utah politics. This was a place where a conservative like Clark could be seen as a moderate, in a deeply red place where government interference were fighting words. "The Utah legislature is very conservative," Clark says. "They don't like the government telling them what to do." Chapter 32. Hunt for Justice. On the legal front, the late winter and spring brought a flurry of motions and countermotions that spoke to the specifics of Reggie's case, but also to broader issues as the legal system wrestled with technology, law, and the brain. On January 24, 2008, Bunderson filed a motion to prohibit the prosecution from introducing diagrams of the crash site, excluding any diagram prepared by Mr. Kaiserman, the only eyewitness. The motion asserted that there was no debris found, there were no skid marks, scuff marks, or gouge marks, and no evidence which could support the preparation of a diagram. The essential point? Bunderson was arguing that there was no way to show precisely where the accident had taken place, on which side of the yellow divider, and if Reggie had swerved into the oncoming lane, it could not be proven how far he'd swerved. J. Just 2 weeks later, on February 8th, Bunderson asked the judge to advise the jury to question the reliability of the farrier. Mr. Kaiserman had only a fleeting moment, if not just a split second, to observe the situation, and he was involved in a major collision himself, Bunderson wrote in his motion. That day, Bunderson filed a handful of motions, the sum of which constituted the essential pieces of his case. One motion went to the heart of what everyone saw as a key issue: Reggie's character. It was just one page, promising supporting documentation to follow that referred to Reggie's history with the LDS mission. It said that the discovery in the trial vaguely references the fact Reggie had gone to the mission training center and then returned. That fact, Bunderson argued, had no bearing on the accident, and, borrowing from the legal vernacular, was too probative, meaning it could carry more weight in the eyes of the jury than was relevant to the case. Another February 8th motion was aimed at disallowing the prosecution from using anything in the trial that Reggie had said to Renlisbacher at the scene of the accident and en route to the hospital. This had to do with Bunderson's assertion that Renlisbacher failed to and was required to read Reggie his Miranda rights. This motion wasn't just aimed at limiting Renlisbacher's testimony. It would serve the perhaps more important aim of keeping Reggie off the stand. After all, if the prosecution could introduce nothing from Reggie's own mouth, then the defense would not have to devise a strategy for refuting it. It would be easier for Reggie to assert his right not to testify in his own trial. Also on February 8th, Bunderson filed a motion that highlighted some of the new issues raised by the state of Utah versus Reggie Shaw. The motion had to do with what was going on inside Reggie's mind, and it raised fascinating questions about the collision of technology, science, and law. The motion sought to disallow the testimony of David Strayer, the professor at the University of Utah, who was expert in distracted driving. Bunderson wanted to avoid Dr. Strayer testifying to the jury that when a motorist is texting, or for that matter talking on the phone, they are unfocused and distracted. Bunderson argued that Strayer would be speculating about Reggie's state of mind, something he argued is not allowed. In turn, Bunderson said Dr. Strayer, an expert, would be telling the jury that Reggie was negligent, taking that decision away from the jury. He wrote, "The opinion of an expert that texting or using a cell phone is distracting or even dangerous is nothing other than telling the jury that such activity is either negligent or criminally negligent." In the prosecution's response to the motion, Linton conceded one point. With respect to a defendant's state of mind when he committed an act, an expert cannot testify that a defendant acted with negligence, or for that matter recklessness, knowledge, or intent, because such an opinion would constitute a legal conclusion. But he also wrote that Dr. Strayer should be allowed to discuss the risks of texting. He is expected to testify that text messaging can cause a person to focus on things other than driving, and that at high speeds, driving while texting is consistent with driving over center lines and, in general, erratic driving. Linton argued that the Utah Supreme Court had ruled that experts were allowed to testify about how certain acts are consistent with certain behaviors. For instance, he cited one sexual abuse case in which the Supreme Court had found that a doctor could testify that a sexually abused child could exhibit sleeplessness, poor appetite, fear of certain individuals, clinging behavior, and urination problems. Linton argued that the Supreme Court found that such testimony didn't necessarily say that a particular alleged victim was abused, but rather that such behaviors could fairly be raised as evidence of such abuse. While Dr. Strayer's opinions will touch upon the ultimate issues of this case, they will not include a conclusion by the doctor that the defendant was negligent. Linton had filed his response on March 17th. A few weeks later, in early April, Bunderson fired back with a 3-page motion that put a fine point on his argument about distraction and frame of mind. Focusing on things other than driving and erratic driving are the very definition of negligence, Bunderson wrote. And he wrote, "This case is unique because the mental element is criminal negligence, and for an expert to testify that text messaging causes someone to fail to pay attention is, at the very least, testifying to an inference of a negligent mental state." What Bunderson was getting at was one of the essential aspects of the case against Reggie, but also about the nature of texting or using a phone while driving. Is it inherently distracting? If that is the case, he thought, and the jury believed that the very act was distracting, then it might determine that Reggie was inherently negligent for having done it. That was very different, Bunderson thought, than, say, eating, which no one was arguing was inherently distracting, not creating a cognitive load. Sure, of course, someone could get distracted by reaching for food, looking away from the road, or even by turning the dial of a car radio, but those were momentary acts, not systemically provable acts of distraction. Bunderson didn't yet know the neuroscience, but he understood the risk. If an activity was inherently distracting, then it could be seen as inherently negligent. He didn't want the jury to hear that at all. On other points raised by Bunderson, Linton argued some and conceded others. For instance, the prosecutor agreed that there was no reason to bring in Reggie's failed mission, and he had never intended to. He wrote in his own motion on this issue, "The state of Utah does not know why the defense believes this. Had the defense called the state would have stipulated not to introduce any information regarding the fact that the defendant had to come home from his mission for personal reasons once and then a second time for the charges in the case. The state agrees this is not relevant." Notably, Linton had referred to Reggie returning from a second mission. Bunderson might not have wanted to have Reggie's first failed mission admitted, but at the same time, the state didn't need the jury to hear that Reggie was so powerfully committed to going on a mission that he tried twice. If not for the state's zealous pursuit of Reggie, he would be serving the church. The character issue could work both ways, and now it was coming out of play. On the way to each court hearing, the Shaws avoided Valley View Drive. They never drove to the crash site or directly past it. Reggie still hadn't been back to the site. It was the elephant on the road, and it would remain unacknowledged. On every trip to Logan, the family did, however, visit the city's majestic temple, the second oldest in Utah, right up against the mountains, viewable from the Cache County Attorney's Office. While she prayed, Mary Jane took to thinking about the Christmas song, "I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day," based on an 1863 poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The verse that struck her had to do with hate. "And in despair I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth," I said. "For hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men." Mary Jane prayed not to hate. Not to hate the system. Not to hate people who were saying things about Reggie and what a horrible person he was. She begged God for help. "Bless us to get through this," she prayed. "Bless us that those who are trying him will see what's in his heart." Chapter 33. Terrell. In January, Jackie got a visitor from Indiana, Gary Maloney, the longtime family friend who'd been the best man at her and Jim's wedding, and lately, a virtual friend. Jackie and Gary had been bonding for months in World of Warcraft. They played after the girls went to bed. They'd pair up their characters. When she played with Moonrise, her night elf hunter, he played with Pam, a dwarf hunter. When she was the human priest she named Seraphim, he played a night elf he named Svarhawk. They went on quests and explored dungeons, and they chatted. When he came to Tremonton in January, visiting family in the area, he spent an evening hanging out at the Ferfaros. He and the family sat in the living room, watching Battlestar Galactica, and something special happened. Cassidy, the youngest girl, went over and sat with Gary. Stephanie then did too. "It was like a first moment for me," Jackie says. "I could be with this guy." In April, after many more nights of online interaction, Gary decided on another visit for May. Jackie told the girls and they asked, "Where's he going to sleep?" "Probably on the couch," Jackie told them. "Why not the bedroom?" They obviously were just trying to make sense of what kind of friend slept with what kind of friends. She explained about how married people share beds. "We're not that kind of friends," Jackie said. Gary came in May, around his birthday. Up until that point, Jackie hadn't had much of a social life, not a single date. She got a babysitter, and for Gary's birthday, they went to an Olive Garden, and then to the movies to see Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Then they went home and sat on the couch and put on Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life. Media, movies, video games, television were their common interests. They sat there quietly, each trying to figure out how to broach their mutual affection. Finally, "I was wondering if we could be a couple," Gary asked her. "Yes." Jackie's reaction was immediate and succinct. That summer, things blossomed further when Gary came for a week-long visit while the kids were with their grandmother. They got some alone time and watched a bunch of movies. For Jackie, their friendship seemed like a version of a real-world happy ending, a realization of her aspiration to move on from Jim's tragic death and provide a stable life for the girls. She told herself she didn't feel guilty, but that June she began having vivid dreams. In one, she was hanging out with Gary and Jim showed up on the doorstep. "I'm not dead," he told her in the dream. Still dreaming, Jackie told him, "That cannot really be." For the victims and their advocate in Terrell, the year 2008 evolved into one of living with uncertainty, under the haze of an amorphous legal cloud and an emotional one. They were adjusting to life without Jim and Keith. If Jackie was seeing some light at the end of the cloud, that was less true for Leila. Her life was a blur of grief and humdrum, punctuated by periodic court hearings. She went back to work as a bookkeeper, keeping the same schedule she had when Keith died, working Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Her income was modest. She made between $25,000 and $30,000 a year, and she now had to grapple with a new bill, healthcare insurance for her and Megan, something Keith's job once covered. The policy cost her $400 per month initially, then leapt to $850. Aggravating the costs was Megan's ongoing struggle with severe kidney stones. More than once, the young lady called her mother in the middle of the night in pain, and the pair rushed to the emergency room. She felt her relationship with her daughter was decent, even improving. Megan would come over regularly for dinner. One of Leila's pleasures was cooking, lots of hearty soups in the winter, and salads as things got warmer. When Megan wasn't there, which was most nights, she'd cook for herself, and then sit down with a book and read with the television going in the background.